Maybe she was coming down with something, Peter thought as he put the chicken in the oven and searched the pantry for what might go along. A can of green beans. Something to make her happy. Maybe she'd caught the flu. He'd go up to her bedroom door and tell her it was all done. No need to worry. He could bring her a plate later or she could come down, whatever she felt like doing. He'd just gotten out a saucepan when he heard his father open the door. Anne? He'd called out, and then, oh, when he crossed into the kitchen to find Peter. School got out early. Where's Mom? Resting, Peter said. I was just... He held up the can of beans.
We'll do that later, buddy. That'll just take a minute when we're ready to eat.
Peter put the can down. He left the saucepan on the stovetop for later.
Well, then can I go out to play for a while? Some of the kids. I saw them. Go on, have fun.
The chicken is...
I'll take care of it.
The first shot of war had not yet been fired. The teams had assembled on the wide stretch of flat yard beside the Maldonado's house. Kate saw him first.
We get Peter,
she called, and every head turned. Did you find it? She asked when he took his spot beside her. They'd drawn boundaries. One team would fire from behind the grove of trees, the other from behind Mr. Maldonado's Cadillac.
Not yet, he said.
A snowball exploded on the front hubcap of the caddy. In an instant, Peter, Kate, and the rest were returning fire, the cold burning their hands, their cheeks, while under their coats their bodies grew warmer. As Kate gathered as many snowballs as she could, Peter crouched beside her, hammering them at the other team faster than she could make them. His nose running, his cheeks stinging, he forgot about the ship, about his mother, about the chicken drums he hoped his father would remember to take out of the oven. Kate was laughing so hard she fell face first into a pile of snow. Their side ran out of ammo. When half their team broke off to build up a store again, the ones who kept fighting got pelted, had to go lie down in the graveyard.
This sucks, Kate's sister Natalie said after a few minutes. I'm going inside.
When she stood up and walked across the battlefield, skirting the dead bodies like they were nothing, the game collapsed and the battlefield became just a yard again. The soldiers became kids. One by one, the others emerged from cover and headed home. The snow began to fall in earnest.
You coming?
Sarah said to Kate as she headed for their front door. The three Gleason sisters crisscrossed traits. Kate looked more like Natalie, but Natalie had dark hair and was at least 4 inches taller than Kate. Sarah and Kate were both blonde, but other than those two details, they didn't look at all alike. All three of them spoke with their hands, like their mother.
In a minute, Kate said.
You going in?
Kate asked Peter when it was just the two of them left.
I guess, he said. My mom made hot chocolate. We could take a thermos to the rocks.
I better not.
Okay,
she said, looking past him to his house, to the upstairs window where his mother was looking down at them.
It's your mom,
Kate said, offering an uncertain wave. Then she dropped her hand and waited, as if giving Peter's mother a chance to wave back.
My mom?
Peter wheeled around, cupped his hand to his eyes.
That's your room, isn't it? Your window?
Kate asked. By the time he stripped off his wet mittens, hat, scarf, coat, and boots, and bounded up the stairs to his room, the ship was in bits. Some things came off easily, as they were made to do in case they needed replacement. The jib, the boom, the crow's nest. But the entire hull was in splinters. Seeing the raw, broken open insides of wood that had been varnished to a shine was like seeing something naked and vulgar, and Peter had to look away. It was in the garage, she said evenly. It was just sitting there on the lid of the garbage can.
I know, Peter said, astonished. He felt dizzy, confused. That's where I left it.
It came to him now in full color, hearing the hollow rumble of the school bus's engine coming around the corner, running into his garage with the ship to place it somewhere safe until his return. You left it where it could slide right off and fall. You left it where it could get damaged. Why?
I was playing with it. I wanted to show it to Kate. You know, because I liked it. I really liked my present mom. And then I left it there because I heard the bus.
Peter looked at the wreckage strewn across his comforter and felt a roar come into his head. His mother put her fingertips to her temples and stood.
Why would you want to show that girl? Why would you take it outside?
I don't know. I just wanted her to see it.
Well, that'll learn you.
She crossed the room and slapped him hard across the mouth.
And that'll learn you.
Peter staggered back, his face numb at first, and then, on a delay, his left cheek felt as if stung by a thousand needles. He touched the corner of his mouth with his tongue to search for blood. As he clutched his cheek, he looked around at his books, his poster of the solar system. What was he meant to learn? He really tried to see it. He felt like he was breathing through a straw.
But you broke it, he said. It was okay when you found it, and then you smashed it.
His voice felt thick as he spoke, and the pressure in his head was so heavy he was afraid something would burst.
You said it cost all that money. It didn't get broken where I left it.
He felt wild all of a sudden. He flew to his bed and whipped the comforter and blankets off, and all the little bits of ship that hadn't already been scattered went flying. He toppled the tower of books on his desk. He threw a basket of magic markers he kept on a shelf. He went to his windowsill and grabbed the snow globe she'd given him when he was just a kindergartner. Santa flying his sleigh high over the Empire State Building. He held it over his head. Brian came running up the stairs to Peter's room, still holding the remote control of the TV.
What the hell is going on?
He saw the shipwreck.
Christ.
Anne gathered her robe around her.
Ask him. Ask him how he treats nice things.
She came over to Peter and shoved him.
Ask him.
Another shove.
Ask him.
Stop it, Anne, Brian said, pulling her away.
Stop!
He threaded his fingers behind his head and stood at the window for a moment with his back to them. When he turned, he said,
Okay, Pete.
He began opening Peter's dresser drawers. He grabbed underwear, an undershirt, sweats. He pushed everything into Peter's chest and told him to shove it all in his backpack. His mother watched them.
What are you doing?
She demanded.
You did this. Brian said calmly. The way you act? You did this.
As Peter followed his father down the stairs, they heard her shrieking after them, though the words were sheared off as soon as Brian closed the front door. Having to wait for the car to warm up cut down on the drama of their exit, and already the adrenaline that had left Peter breathless had slowed. His cheek still stung, but it was better now. It didn't feel right, leaving her alone in the house with that stunned expression on her face. And he circled back to the idea that there'd been a misunderstanding of some kind. There was a piece of the story either she was missing or he was. Next to him, fiddling with the heating vents so they were all pointed toward the windshield, his father was caught up in some private riptide that Peter could feel only faintly. Brian banged the steering wheel with the heel of his hand. He did it again. The snow was already thick on the street and mailboxes, the battle scars the kids had left on the Maldonado's side yard already made smooth again. Once they could finally back out of the driveway, the car fishtailed toward their mailbox, and then all the way down the block. His father leaned forward over the steering wheel to better glimpse the road in between frantic sweeps of the wiper blades. They turned onto Madison, onto Central. A plow flashed its lights at them and passed by, followed by a salt truck. Up ahead, they could see that Overlook Drive and its steep hill had been barricaded. All the traffic lights in town had been changed to flashing yellows so that no one would consider stopping short for a red and spinning out of control. Peter was clutching his backpack so hard his hands began to cramp. His father let the car roll to a stop in the middle of Central Avenue. Everything around them was the perfect stillness of a black and white photograph. A ghostly hush that settled over the parked cars, the abandoned playground,
the gazebo on Central that hosted jazz quartets on summer Fridays and now held nothing but silence. The wipers beat on.
"Damn it,"
he said. "Pretty bad out," Peter said.
"Yeah."
"Where are we going?" His father rubbed his eyes.
"I just need to think for a sec, buddy."
A blue car appeared in the distance and moved toward them. Peter didn't recognize it as Mr. Gleason's car until it was right beside them. Both men rolled down their windows, and the snow swept into the car like the storm had just been waiting for a chance to scoop them up.
"The roads are a mess," Mr. Gleason shouted. "Everything all right?"
"Fine. We're fine,"
Peter's father answered. It was his cop voice, sure of itself, full of authority.
"Is that Peter? Where are you guys heading?"
"Wanted to rent a movie," Peter's father said. "We'll be stuck inside from the looks of things."
"Everything's closed," Mr. Gleason said. "Parkway too."
For a moment, Peter thought Mr. Gleason was going to get out of his car and come peer into theirs.
"We're too late then. Waited too long,"
Peter's father shouted with sort of a goofy look on his face, like he'd been caught doing something he'd be teased about later on. The snow was belting him in the face and immediately turning into beads of water against his warm skin.
"Take it easy,"
Mr. Gleason shouted into the whirling storm.
"Will do,"
shouted Peter's father. With the windows rolled up again, the car seemed even more quiet. The storm whistled, and every once in a while a gust blew adrift from the ground, so that it looked as though snow was falling up and down in every which way. They remained idling in the middle of the street. Eventually, Peter's father gestured toward the auto shop on the corner.
"Flat roof,"
he said.
"You see?
He's already got at least a foot up there. I'd shovel that off before morning if I were him." "Wouldn't it be dangerous to go up there in this storm?" Peter asked.
"Sure, but if he doesn't want it to collapse."
Brian shrugged, placed his hands on the wheel at 10 and 2. Peter looked building by building to check for flat roofs. Pies on Pizza, Nail Fetish, Heads You Win Beauty Parlor, all closed. "I can't have friends over," Peter said without looking at his father. "Ever. I can't have them in there, even when she seems fine."
"No, that's true."
"Why?"
"Your mom, she's just, I don't know. She's sensitive. She gets worked up. But trust me, some kids, they've got it worse than you, my friend. Worse by a mile. Some of the things I've seen, you don't even want to know. But look, you have a lot. You know what I was doing at your age? I was working. I was delivering papers. My mother, she drank all day long, Pete. You're probably not old enough yet to know what that means. She put booze in her coffee and her orange juice, everything. By your age, I was getting calls from the neighbors, from the grocery store. Hey, come collect your mother, Brian. She's in bad shape. And she'd be kissing me. So sorry, sweetie. And then I'd have to let her pretend she was helping me with homework so she wouldn't feel so bad about it.
But you said she brought you and your friends to the polo grounds that time, that she bought tickets for everyone." His face softened as he thought back, and after a moment, he nodded.
"That's right. I told you that?"
"Yeah. It was me, your uncle, and a couple kids from the building. One time, did I ever tell you this? She signed a test my friend Gerald failed. It was snowing, just like today, and he carried the test in his hand the whole walk home. It was all rumpled and wet, with a big red F over his name. He needed a parent signature, and he was so scared about it, he came to our apartment first to think out a strategy. She must have been listening because she told him to hand over the test so she could take a look. Next thing, she's signing his mother's name big and bold right across the top of the page. 'Don't worry so much,' she says to him. Then she gave us money to go buy ourselves a candy bar. Our teacher never even questioned it."
"Your friends liked her. They loved her.
I wish you could have known her."
Then he put on the car's hazards and slowly, slowly drove back home. 3. On New Year's Eve, 1990, the year Kate and Peter were in 8th grade, Anne Stanhope walked up to the deli counter at Food King and took a number. She looked beautiful. Her coat was long and narrow. She was without a hat on that cold day, but her scarf, a tartan plaid, was looped twice around her neck. Mrs. Wortham, who worked in the podiatrist's office in town, was also waiting and noted the height of Anne's heels. 4 inches, maybe more. Dainty things, especially considering the slush and salt-coated streets outside. She thought, oh, well, she must have come from work. Some people don't get the day off, and then she remembered that Anne Stanhope was a nurse. Maybe she's going to a party, Mrs. Wortham decided. After taking her number from the spool of tickets, and without saying hello to anyone, Anne stood off to the side, like the others who were waiting for one of the hair-netted employees to turn the dial on the counter. 43 was called. 44? One by one, various residents of Gillam stepped forward and spoke their orders across the tall glass display. 1 pound of smoked ham, thickly sliced. 1/2 pound of provolone. The store was crowded that day. People had worked through their Christmas leftovers and wanted a fresh start for the new year. Anne Stanhope held the number 51. 45? 46? 47? Johnny Murphy, who'd been sent to the store by his mother, spotted one of his old high school baseball coaches. Home on break from his first year at college, Johnny greeted the older man warmly and stood at the counter blocking the way until someone joked that Mr. Big Time Pitcher had better shove over. He'd gone to college on scholarship, and the whole town had followed his senior year wins over the neighboring towns that were wealthier, had better facilities. Number 48 forgot the list his wife had written before sending him off, so he hemmed and hawed up there until he settled on London broil and 1 pound of German potato salad. 49 and 50 were called up together, two opposite ends of the counter. It was busy now, the numbers ticking by more quickly because the manager had sent help to get through the midday rush. Next thing Anne Stanhope knew, everyone who'd been waiting alongside her seemed to be ordering, or seemed to have ordered already. There were people who'd come after her. She couldn't have described them. She felt merely a gathering presence beside and behind her, who now had their meats and cheeses and salads and were on their way. Only Anne Stanhope remained. The employees behind the counter were so busy that the dial was at 52, and then almost instantly at 60. 61 was called. People stepped around her, in front of her, and she felt, right down to her fingertips, a kind of quickening. The gathering of momentum was familiar, though she hadn't felt it in a while. Her heart and her pulse and some wild fury coming together in a rhythm that gained force and speed the longer she stayed quiet, the more she looked around and noticed. Her peripheral vision sparked and distorted the edges of everything so that when she turned quickly to look at something, it moved just out of sight. And even while everything inside her body seemed to speed up, everything outside of her body, the movements of the other shoppers, the reaching and lowering of boxes and packages into carts, slowed. A carton of milk had a wet drip gathering along a cardboard seam. The tip of an old man's nose was so vein-threaded it looked blue, and when he went to rub it, she saw the delicate hairs inside his nostrils, every bit as private as hair in any other part of the body. In the distant front of the store, the automatic doors wheezed open, and she could feel the cold air racing down the aisle to slide under the collar of her coat. She could see that the people around her didn't care that she'd been missed. She took a step back and saw, in vivid color, because her mind was that sharp at moments like this, everything spotlighted so that details she'd overlooked were now glaringly obvious. That, in fact, they'd orchestrated her exclusion for private, petty reasons that weren't worth trying to understand. They smirked and nodded and gave each other signals. They'd banded together and decided that number 51 would get skipped. She stepped out of her heels to get a better sense of what was happening, to defend herself if need be. And in one nimble motion, she bent and swept the shoes from the floor, tossed them in her basket. She unwound the scarf from her neck. Wait! She called out, raising her hand like a grade schooler who'd just thought of the answer. She pushed forward to the counter. Are you all right? A woman standing nearby asked. You can't take off your shoes. Why can't I? Anne snapped, turning on the woman to study her. The woman's lips were rubbery, untrustworthy, and she had shades of laziness in her expression that Anne found disgusting. Some distant part of her recognized the woman as Eucharistic minister at St. Bartholomew's, and she was amazed she'd never noted how revolting she was before this. This woman had put her filthy fingertips on the host, the body of Christ, and Anne had taken it into her mouth. She felt her stomach rise and a crawling at the back of her throat. She put a fist to her pursed mouth and willed herself not to vomit. "Stop!" she shouted when the feeling passed. Everyone, from the seafood case to the imported cheeses, stopped talking and looked. She held up her ticket and stepped forward. "It's my turn!" There was something pathetic in her voice. She could hear it as if she were listening to someone else. And in case they thought she was going to cry, she repeated herself, louder, with more determination. But in the few short steps she took to the counter, she felt the cold of the linoleum floor on her bare feet as twin cramps at the bottom of her calves. She forgot what she wanted or why she was there, only that every single person in her vicinity had plotted against her. "How dare you!" she said to the elderly man standing in front of the pasta salads. And then, "Stop looking at me!" "I'm very sorry," the man said, stepping aside. "Please, go right ahead." "Stop looking at me!" she repeated. "I'm not. I wasn't." "There's no need to raise your voice, honey," he said softly. And everyone understood he was trying to placate her, that this was a situation that could go 100 different ways, and he was trying to get it to go the calmest, easiest way possible. "I'm very sorry about that. It was an honest mistake, but now you go right ahead."
"Stop looking at me!"
she shouted at him. And then she swung around and shouted it in the general direction of the rest of the store. The taller of the two hair-netted women behind the counter asked her in a firm tone to please lower her voice while the other called the manager. Anne turned slowly in a circle, taking in everything and everyone. And then she walked over to the pyramid of crackers. Stone ground, whole wheat, sesame, plain, and bumped it with her hip. When it toppled, she wrapped her arms around herself and squeezed her eyes shut. There'd been a dozen people standing around, but now there were two dozen, more. No one said a word.
"Stop looking at me," she said at a normal volume.
Then she covered her ears and began to howl. Over the loudspeaker, someone paged the manager for a second time. Peter, who'd opted to wait in the car listening to the top 100 countdown, had just looked at the dashboard clock when he heard an ambulance in the distance. When it seemed that the siren couldn't get any louder, it just got a little bit louder until it pulled up to the front of the supermarket and went abruptly silent. He watched in the side-view mirror for a moment, and then he turned and watched out the back windshield of the car. There were people gathered, and the EMTs were waving them back. A police cruiser pulled up behind the ambulance. A second cruiser approached from the south lot. Peter had been at Food King once when a man had a heart attack. The man had been holding a gallon of milk, and though Peter hadn't seen him fall, he'd seen the gallon container glug-glug-glugging milk from its throat, spreading down the dairy aisle while the man on the ground clutched his shoulder. His father had pulled him away before Peter could see what happened next. Thinking about it, Peter wondered why he hadn't thought of the man again until now. Death was something for grown-ups to worry about, but still, he knew that when his time came, he didn't want it to come at Food King. Janet Jackson was up for the second time, and Peter slumped down in his seat. He didn't see how they'd get through all 100 songs before midnight, as the DJ had promised. When he looked up, an old man he recognized as Chris Smith's grandfather was standing at the driver's side window. Mr. Smith made a cycle motion with his fist, and Peter rolled down the window.
"It's Peter, right? You know me? My grandson is in your class? Listen, your mom wasn't feeling well in the store. Nothing to worry about, but they're going to take her over to the hospital. Can I give you a lift home? I'm glad I spotted you."
Peter blinked at Mr. Smith for a moment, and then he got out of the car so fast that he left the keys in the ignition. What happened? He asked, looking now at the crowd at the front of the store in a different light. He began jogging through the parking lot. When he saw that someone was being carried out on a stretcher, he began to run. Mom? He called from the back of the crowd that had gathered. She bucked when she heard his voice, and one of the EMTs stumbled.
Peter?
She shouted, her voice thin with urgency, and Peter felt every face in the crowd turn to look at him. They stepped back so that he could make his way.
Quickly?
She shouted to him, but he didn't know what she meant. He noticed that a third EMT was carrying her shoes and her scarf. The tips of her fingers looked bluish and cold, and her hair was parted differently than it had been when she walked away from the car. He wondered if they'd forced her onto the stretcher, and if she'd fought them. Her coat was draped over her like a blanket.
Quickly!
She shouted again, her eyes wild and locked on his, but he froze in place, having no idea what to do. The same faces that had turned to look at him now turned away. The coat shifted, and he saw that her hands were strapped down. Her ankles, too. He began to shiver. They lifted her into the back of the ambulance, and a police officer waved everyone back, including Peter.
Peter, quickly!
She shrieked. Peter looked at the officer blocking his way. That's me, he whispered. I'm Peter. Can't I go in there with her?
Peter?
Mr. Smith said, coming up beside him. Why don't I take you home, and you can call your dad from my house? Mrs. Smith will make you a sandwich. But he lived with Chris, Peter remembered, and then Chris would know, and then their whole class would know. His shoulders were quaking so violently now that he knew everyone must be noticing. Mr. Smith put an arm around him, but that only made it worse. The police officer asked, "You're her son?" He introduced himself as Officer Dully. "Yes," he said. Officer Dully asked him for his full name and address, and when he didn't answer, Mr. Smith gave the officer Peter's full name and told him he was pretty sure the Stanhopes lived on Jefferson. That, yes, Peter lived with his mother. Yes, his father was in the picture. They were talking about his dad now. Officer Dully disappeared inside the ambulance for a few minutes and then came back. No one seemed in any rush to get anywhere. "Did she have a heart attack?" Peter asked when he returned. "No," Officer Dully said, without indicating if whatever did happen was better or worse. "What precinct is your dad in?" Officer Dully asked. But Peter couldn't remember. It was right there in his brain, but he couldn't come up with it. "He's on the job, right?" Peter nodded. It was decided that he would hang out at the Smith's house until they got in touch with his father. "Wait," Peter said, stepping away from Mr. Smith's hand on his shoulder and watching as the ambulance doors closed. "I want to go with her." But they were already pulling away from the curb. "She's fine, Peter. She'll be fine." "Well, then can't you just drop me off at home?" The ambulance paused at the intersection at Middletown Road and whooped the siren twice to let the other cars know it was going to drive through. "My dad will be home pretty soon."
"Are you sure that's what you want?"
"I'm sure."
On the short drive, Mr. Smith said it was a tiring time of year, really, when a person thought about it. It was a happy time of year, sure, with all the family and the celebrating, but overwhelming, too, for some people. For a start, look at all the money being spent. "Plus, it's different for women," he added. "They always feel like everything has to be just so, with the dinners and the entertaining. You need this bowl to match this bowl, you need this spoon. Used to be people made gingerbread cookies and got maybe one present. But these days, things are different." Then he looked at Peter like that explained everything. Peter felt like telling him that he and his father had put up their tree. He alone had baked cookies when the day came for the class bake sale. He'd just followed the directions on the package and they'd turned out delicious. Then he'd put them in a shoebox like he'd seen the other kids' moms do. When his mother came home, she snapped at him that he'd forgotten to line the box with foil or wax paper. Who would want a cookie from a box shoes had been sliding around in? She made it sound as if he'd stored the cookies inside a public toilet. All those ingredients wasted. He'd used the last of the butter. She slammed the fridge. The last of the brown sugar. She slammed the cabinet door. But then, when she saw the baking sheet and bowls washed and drying on the counter, she stopped ranting. and it was as if an invisible hand had been clapped over her mouth. She ran her fingers along the table and found they came up clean. She stood before the shoebox and selected a cookie from the top of the pile. He waited. He watched. Finally, she said quietly that they were so good it would be a shame anyway to sell them for only 25 cents apiece. They were extraordinary. "We'll keep these for ourselves," she said. "Tomorrow I'll get some from the bakery for you to sell at school." "What happened in the store?" he asked Mr. Smith as they rounded the corner onto Jefferson.
"Did someone say something to her? Was someone rude?"
"I don't know," Mr. Smith said. "I really don't."
"She's just sensitive," Peter said.
As they drove down Jefferson, Mr. Gleason was outside pulling a garbage can to the curb. He looked up at Mr. Smith's car and watched it slow to a stop at Peter's driveway. "Is that Francis Gleason?" Mr. Smith asked, leaning over the steering wheel. He sounded relieved. The two men spoke at the end of the driveway while Peter retrieved the key from under the rock and went into his house. They were still talking even after Peter poured himself a glass of water and went up to his bedroom. He chugged the water with his back to the window and counted to 40. When he turned around, they were still there, except they'd turned their backs to his house, as if they knew he might try to read their lips and figure out what they were saying. She had a gun in her handbag. She hadn't taken it out, she hadn't even mentioned it, but they found it in the ambulance when they were going through her things. All she wanted was the secret weight of it hanging off her shoulder, cold and solid when she rummaged through her bag for her wallet. She hadn't planned on using it. She couldn't even imagine using it. It was just a thing to have. A thing that would surprise people if it came to it. A thing that surprised her when she remembered it was there and what it was made to do. But the EMT who spotted it handed her whole bag over to the cop like it was on fire. "Your husband, he's on the job?" the cop asked, holding Brian's little off-duty five-shot away from himself like it was contaminated. "Local or city?" He popped open the cylinder. "Jesus Christ," he said, and tilted the gun so that five bullets slid neatly into his palm. Anne Stanhope refused to answer. Once she'd stopped howling in the store, she was unable to speak. She had no interest in speaking. Speaking was a habit she'd gotten into years ago, in the distant past, and now that she'd stopped, she felt no desire to start again. It was pointless anyway. All the blah, blah, blabbing, and still no one understood each other. The EMT came at her with a small plastic cup at the bottom of which a large yellow and white pill rolled around. He lifted her head to place a pill on her tongue, and she spit it back at him. "Why'd you have this in your bag today, Anne?" They were idiots, she thought. Each one more idiotic than the last. They had no brains for nuance. They had no conception of a way of thinking that was different than their own. "Your husband, he left this at home?" They assumed Brian was at work, but Brian wasn't at work. He was at the garage not a mile away from Food King, hoping the mechanic there could squeeze 6 more months of life out of his Chevy. He'd left the gun where he always left it when he was off duty, on top of the bookcase in the family room. Yes, he was supposed to be wearing it, but he couldn't be bothered. He was in Gillum. Why would he need it? Anne would have had it back on the bookcase without him ever realizing it was gone. In the fluorescent light of the hospital corridor, in full view of any person who might happen down the hall, they unstrapped her from the gurney and lifted her onto a hospital bed. Someone rolled her over and someone else tugged down her pants until she could feel her bare behind was exposed for the world to see. She began laughing. They told her to be still, so she wagged her behind a little to show them she didn't care. Someone pushed a needle into her and she noticed she was sobbing. She didn't remember that she'd stopped laughing. She turned her face to the mattress so they wouldn't see. Now the sheet under her face was damp and would stay damp until they changed the bedding or moved her again. Someone put thick socks on her bare feet. When they moved away from her, she figured she had 2 or 3 minutes, maybe less. It all depended on what they'd given her. The cop was hovering around the nurse's station, The attending physician was with another patient, so she summoned all her strength and stood from the bed. It felt as if they'd attached lead weights to her wrists and ankles. She had a lead anchor strapped to her chest. She moved down the hall and had the same feeling she'd had as a kid trying to run in water. Right, left, one, two, working hard but not getting anywhere. She'd grown up swimming at Killiney Beach, the stones in the water there rattling around inside the waves like bones in a bag. Diving under, you risked getting pummeled. Her mouth was hanging open and her lips were dry. One foot in front of the other, she made it to the end of the hall and slipped out through the swinging doors. They still had her shoes, her coat, her bag. But at home she had more shoes. She had another coat. When she reached the lobby, she put her hand on the reception desk for a moment to catch her breath, and the attendant didn't even notice she was there. When she stepped outside, there was a cab waiting, and she had just enough strength left to open the door and collapse onto the smooth bench seat, the most comfortable seat she'd ever sat upon. It was warm in the cab, and the driver caught her eye in the rear view as if he'd been waiting for her. She knew then that everything had turned around since the supermarket, and now the world was falling over itself to win back her favor. "Gillum," she said. 1711 Jefferson Street. She said it slowly, as if speaking to a child. She knew she wouldn't be able to repeat it. She closed her eyes and slept. It was Francis Gleason's face she saw next. His stubbled jaw was different from Brian's. He had a nice face, really. Not as handsome as Brian's, but nice enough. Dependable. A big Irish head like a cabbage. He was holding her tight. She wanted to ask him about the sound of the waves in Galway, if it was the same bag of bones as in Dublin. He'd tried to talk to her about Ireland once. Early on. Lena Gleason was spilling over in those years between the breasts and the belly and the wet-mouthed babies hanging from her. But now Anne wished she'd been kinder. He was carrying her easily, and just as if he entered her house any day of his life, he continued past the threshold, all the way upstairs, and laid her on her bed. She decided if he tried to rape her, she'd just let him and deal with it later because she didn't have the strength to fight. She tried to tell him there was money for the cab in her wallet, but her mouth didn't work, and she had no wallet. Her feet were so cold. Peter thought he and his mother might be able to keep the whole thing from his father if they thought it out and worked together. She hadn't told him what to do, but he figured they had time. He knew his father wouldn't find it unusual to come home to her asleep upstairs. But then, after carrying his mother up the stairs, Mr. Gleason didn't go home like Peter expected him to. "Your mother's resting," he said, and asked if Peter would like to go over to his house for a while. Kate wasn't home, but Peter could watch a movie with Natalie and Sarah. When Peter refused, Mr. Gleason just sat down on the Stanhope's porch step and waited. Peter couldn't remember if he'd turned off the car ignition or if it was still up there idling in the Food King parking lot, still ticking off the top 100 hits of 1990. Then the police officer who'd been asking Peter all those questions at Food King showed up. He'd headed straight to 1711 Jefferson Street as soon as Anne was discovered missing from the hospital. Mr. Maldonado was outside taking down his Christmas lights, even though it was after dusk by then, and Peter watched him look over at Officer Dully in his Navy uniform. Officer Dully and Mr. Gleason talked on the lawn, and when Brian finally came home, Peter watched from the window as they spoke to him and then stepped aside as he rushed into the house and swept his hand back and forth across the top of the bookcase. Mr. Smith phoned to make sure Peter was okay. As soon as he'd gotten home and told his wife everything that had happened, his wife had reprimanded him for dropping Peter off, for leaving him alone when it would be dark soon. What a thing for a boy to cope with by himself. "Slow down," Brian Stanhope said, stretching the phone cord as far away from Mr. Gleason and Officer Dully as possible. "Now say all that again, would you?" For the next few hours, there were dealings at the adult level that Peter couldn't quite follow. His father noticed him sitting on the staircase in the dark, listening, and sent him to his room. But he returned not 2 minutes later and listened more. Mr. Gleason and his father were in the same precinct again, Peter gathered, like they'd been for a few years when they were rookies, but now their precinct was in Manhattan, the 2-6 near Columbia University. He remembered now. Mr. Gleason had a brogue that was different from his mother's, but they both said Brian, like Brian, blending the syllables into one.
Brian, Mr. Gleason said, no one wants you to get jammed up.
Officer Dully's expression confirmed this was true. His father raised his voice.
I was at home. I was off duty.
Mr. Gleason pointed out that, in fact, Brian had not been at home. In fact, he was at the auto shop on Sentinel, and now he was up a fucking creek. Mr. Gleason sounded both angry and disgusted. And for the first time, Peter wondered if Kate's dad was his dad's boss. He tried to remember how the ranks went. His dad was a patrolman. Mr. Gleason was a lieutenant.
Get organized, Brian, Mr. Gleason said. You have to think, he said, jabbing the side of his own head as he said it.
Peter tried to peer around the banister to see his father's face where the weak light from the corner lamp found it. Once, when Mrs. Duven told Peter he had to get his act together in front of all the other kids, he felt his face burn and was afraid he would cry. He prayed his father wasn't crying, but he couldn't see his face, only his knee, the leg of his pants. They were quiet in there for a long time. Then, without warning, they seemed to decide something. Officer Dully handed his father a gun that Peter realized was his father's own gun. His father shoved it into the waistband of his jeans. His mother slept and slept. 1991 arrived, winter break ended, and Peter went back to school. On that first school day of the new year, he made himself a good breakfast. He packed his lunch. He brushed his teeth. His mother came downstairs as he was rinsing his cereal bowl, but she didn't speak to him at first. Instead, she opened the window over the sink and closed her eyes to meet the blast of cold air that rushed in.
You're exactly like him, she said after a minute, still with her eyes closed.
Like who? Like Dad? Peter said. He knew she didn't mean it as a compliment.
Like Dad? She mimicked, exaggerating his expression without looking at him, making her face dopey and stupid, like she was performing for an audience she hoped to make laugh.
Like Dad? Like Dad?
He calmly took his backpack from the peg by the door and fitted it over his shoulders. He felt lonely all of a sudden. Everything in their house was lonely. The dark china cabinet filled with fragile things no one ever touched, the fake plant sitting next to the sofa, the crooked window shade, a silence so violent he wanted to clap his hands over his ears. The bus honked outside.
Bye, he said.
She made a wave in the air like she was swatting a fly.
Did something happen to your mom? Kate asked when they'd taken their seats on the bus.
No, Peter said.
I thought I heard my parents talking. At school, none of the kids said anything, not even Chris Smith. Peter could tell Kate he knew, but he didn't know what he'd even say. His mom took pills now. That was new. He could tell Kate that they'd shown up by the kitchen sink on New Year's Day, that there were two big amber bottles, and she took one pill from each with a huge glass of water. Then she sort of leaned over the sink for a minute and groaned. Sometimes his father picked up the bottles and held them up to the light, shifted the contents a bit like he was counting how many were inside.
Is Mom sick? Peter had asked one evening.
Who? Mom? His father said, and didn't answer.
She returned to work the same week Peter returned to school. She'd taken her leftover vacation days at Christmas, and everything that happened fit neatly into that 2-week frame. No one mentioned Food King, or the ambulance, or Mr. Gleason carrying her inside. But after a few weeks, Peter could feel something new stirring. A shift in air pressure,
a tilt in a direction he had to reorient himself toward. Breakfast, school, homework, playing. The days and weeks looked mostly the same as they always had. After Mass on Sundays, they still slipped out the side door while the other families stood around and talked out front. Now they bought their groceries at the more expensive store two towns away, and whenever they left, his mother would stand by their car for a minute to study the receipt with a downturned mouth. But that wasn't it. Ever since the new year, it was as if what they were saying to each other, he and his mother and his father, was not really what they were saying to each other. His mother seemed better. When the amber bottles were near empty, two full ones replaced them. On Valentine's Day, she left a heart-shaped chocolate on his dinner plate and one for his father, too. One evening, she shared a joke she heard at work. Three surgeons walk into a bar, and his father had smiled. Still, he seemed always on the verge of saying something and then, at the last moment, changing his mind. She sensed it, too. Some nights, when he didn't say much, she'd jump up and fill his plate with seconds before he was quite finished with firsts. She'd go to the freezer and get ice for his drink. She'd never been like that before. "I'll do that," she'd say when he started to clear the dishes. And he'd let her do it, retreating to the sofa. Later, when Peter would come down from his bedroom to tell them he'd finished his homework, he was going to bed, he'd find them on opposite ends of the room, his dad staring at the TV, his mother flipping through a magazine, glancing over at him every time she turned the page. And then one morning, while he was getting ready for school and his mother was getting ready for work, Peter ran downstairs to see if there were any clean socks in the dryer and almost slipped on a glossy pamphlet at the bottom of the stairs. The pamphlet seemed to be about a golf course in South Carolina. His father used to golf, Peter knew, or at least he'd purchased a set of clubs in hopes of learning. He'd promised to show Peter one day when he got tall enough. The man on the cover of the pamphlet had just hit a ball and was smiling as he watched it sail away. On the inside, there was a picture of a man and a woman on what looked to be a date. There were lists of numbers and prices. Studios, 1, 2, 3 bedrooms, seasonal rentals or year-round. Peter was the one who took in the mail most days, but he didn't remember seeing it. He put it on a table in case it was important, hunted down socks, and returned to his bedroom. When he was fully dressed, he looked out his bedroom window and watched his dad shovel out his car after a surprise March snowstorm. He watched his dad turn the shovel over and tap the icy windshield with the edge of the handle. The ice fractured into shards, and he removed a glove to pry them off, one by one, flicking them onto the driveway. Every once in a while, he'd shade his eyes with his hand and look off down the length of Jefferson. "He doesn't want to be here," Peter thought. "He wants to leave." The idea landed lightly and easily, and as soon as Peter noticed it there, everything that hadn't quite made sense again. He heard his father stomping snow off his boots on the mat outside, and then the squeal of the rubber weather strip on the bottom of the door as he entered the house. When Peter went down for breakfast, the pamphlet was gone. But weeks went by and nothing happened. Spring came. Baseball season began. His father said that it was high time Peter went to a real game. He'd get the list of home games and decide on a date. The tulips pushed up along the side of the Gleason's house. The days were warmer, and Peter and Kate got off the bus each day with their uniform sweaters tied around their waists. They began practicing for graduation. Kate had been paired with John Dills for the processional. There were more boys than girls in the grade, so Peter and the second tallest boy had to walk down together. They'd be off to high school soon, and then things would speed up. A driver's license, a job, college, freedom. And in the meantime, it would be fine if things stayed exactly as they were. And for a few weeks, things did. 4. There was a spot near the rocks where, if they positioned themselves just right, they could glimpse Peter's mother's car through the Maldonado's arborvitae before it turned onto Jefferson. Peter had a bloom of acne across his forehead, and he knew Kate had noticed. He wore his Mets cap to school that morning and took it off only when the second bell rang. At the end of the day, he dug it out of his backpack and held it on his lap, ready to return it to his head the instant they lined up for the buses. Kate's legs were scabbed from a weekend softball game where she'd slid badly into third base. She couldn't seem to stop herself from running her hands over the scabs, as if she wanted to compare the roughness there to the smoothness of the rest of her skin. Peter caught himself following the path of her hands as if in a trance. Kate had recently pointed out how much thicker and stronger Peter's legs were than hers. "Hey," she'd said, shimmying closer beside him one afternoon, both of them in shorts and sneakers, both of them sitting on the curb waiting to see if any of the other kids would come by. "Look!" When her skin brushed his, he startled, moved away. She was quiet after that. And when he spoke to her next, "Did you hear Joey Maldonado bought a car?" She blushed. That day, a late May afternoon, their backpacks stuffed with textbooks and information on the 8th grade graduation ceremony that was just a few short weeks away, Peter vowed to keep things light. But it was weighing on him. This strange thing that was happening between him and Kate. Sean Barnett had told the boys that he liked Kate, that he was pretty sure she liked him back, and he hadn't even looked at Peter when he said it. "What the hell?" Peter said, not sure why he felt so furious. "What?" Sean said. "Aren't you guys cousins or something?"
No. We're definitely not cousins."
"Well, have you kissed her?"
Every head turned to study him. Every boy in the 8th grade who'd gathered to play stickball in the parking lot, every face waiting to hear what he'd say.
"What makes you think she likes you back?" Peter had asked, stupidly, and felt in that instant whatever claim he had over Kate evaporate in their eyes.
"I just know," Sean said.
"How do you know?" Peter asked.
"Because I really don't think so."
He said it in a way that implied privilege, like Kate would have told him if she did, and in doing so hoped to remind everyone that no one knew Kate Gleason as well as he did. And she really would have told him, he considered. Or at least, he thought she would have. There was nothing Kate appreciated more than information, insight into what the boys said when the girls were not around. But he didn't want to tell her about Sean Barnett in case it gave her an idea to like him back. So with one eye on the Maldonado's arborvitae, he stepped from the shortest rock to the next tallest to the next, as he confessed that the boys in their class had all agreed to throw easy pitches to Laura Fumagalli during stickball so that she'd connect and send the ball past Monsignor Repetto's black Mercedes, the only car allowed in the school lot during recess. A home run meant they could watch her boobs move under her uniform shirt as she ran around the bases. Kate nodded from where she was sprawled on the grass, with the same serious expression she wore when she took in their history lesson or pre-algebra. He could see a tiny flicker of jealousy pass through her, but it was only a flicker, and was immediately drowned out by admiration for their slyness and for the way they stuck together. She nodded as if in complete agreement that this made sense.
"You won't tell her, right?" Peter said.
"Of course not," Kate said, insulted. She stood abruptly, walked over to the middle rock, and executed a perfect standing jump as if her legs had springs. She looked over to see if Peter was impressed. He shrugged, but couldn't stop himself from smiling. She poked him in the belly. "Pretty good. Say it." And just as Kate began to tell him that Laura's mother had taken her bra shopping in 5th grade, they both leaped to the tallest boulder at the very same time, and Kate slipped, catching her chin on the hard edge of the rock as she fell off. Peter jumped down beside her.
"Kate, are you okay?"
he asked. He put his hand on her face.
"I think I broke a tooth," Kate said.
And with one hand in her hair, Peter put his thumb against her bottom lip as a signal to open up. He lightly ran his finger along the edges of her teeth. She could taste salt on his fingertip. When he glanced at her, he saw that she was watching him closely, searching for his eyes underneath the brim of his cap.
"There's a ton of blood," he said, withdrawing his hand so fast it was as if she'd bitten him.
Kate sat up and leaned over to spit. She wiped her mouth with her forearm and then she spit some more.
"Oh, hey, shit, P,"
Peter, she said then, the words thick and muffled, like she'd just left the dentist after a filling. She nodded at Peter's back door and he looked over. There was his mother, squinting into the yard. Peter scrambled to his feet. His mother had crossed the yard in an instant, was standing over them before Peter even had a chance to think. It was as if she'd not only seen what had happened, but she could also see what they were thinking, whatever was beginning in their minds and hearts. She just... Inside, his mother said. But I only...
Now.
Wait, Kate said. And Peter turned to Kate even as he felt his mother's anger rise. He was just helping me, Kate said to Peter's mother as she gradually rose to her feet. We were just talking, and I fell. I hit my jaw. You can see I'm bleeding. Kate put her hand on Peter's arm to stay him. Shut up, Peter thought. He shook his head as discreetly as he could, and he knew that Kate caught it, but chose to ignore it. You're a nurse, right? Kate said. She leaned over and spit more blood. Her point was so clear she might as well have said it. Thanks for your concern. Mrs. Stanhope took two quick steps closer to her. Peter flinched and Kate stepped back. But when she didn't hit her, Peter thought, for a moment, that she was going to help. That as mad as she was going to make sure Kate was okay before she dealt with him. But she stopped, just short of Kate, and didn't seem to have the least interest in discovering where the blood was coming from. She leaned over like she had a secret to whisper in Kate's ear. Kate watched her eyes as they traveled over her hair, down her body, down even to her white kids, which she'd threaded with blue laces. You think you're so smart? Anne said finally. A few mornings earlier, she'd taken the usual two pills out of the bottles, but instead of swallowing them, she placed them inside an empty eggshell she'd returned to the carton after breaking the egg over the small frying pan. She reassembled the egg to make it look whole again, and then she placed it in the trash. Are you supposed to do that? Peter had asked. Am I supposed to do what? She asked, as she crossed the room toward him, put her hand on his cheek. It felt like a caress at first, but she squeezed harder and harder until he pulled away.
Excuse me? Kate said now.
I said, you think you're so smart, don't you? Kate looked at Peter as if he might be able to translate. From Kate's side of the yard came the sound of the Gleason screen door squealing open and then slapping shut. Lena came rushing outside.
What happened?
She asked, concern and love and reprimand all tied up into one. She seemed to take stock of everything so quickly that Peter felt embarrassment well up in his chest. All along, everyone had known exactly what his mother was like, only they hadn't said anything.
Into the house, Lena said to Kate.
We weren't even doing anything. Can someone tell me why we're in trouble? Get into the goddamn house.
This is bullshit, Kate said, and her mother whipped around and slapped her across the face.
Mom!
Kate choked out as she staggered and tried not to cry.
Geez, Mrs. Gleason, she's already hurt.
You shut your mouth, his own mother said. We will leave them all one day, Peter thought, not for the first time. We'll live on our own, and we won't have to listen to any of these people. Inside, his mother paced while Peter held the back of a kitchen chair, refusing to sit. When she finally spoke, she said it showed what kind of people they were. The Gleasons. Trash. Imagine hitting a person in public, in front of a neighbor. Peter thought of all the things he could say to her right then. He thought about how much bigger he'd gotten since the year before. He was as tall as his father now. He could tear down every cabinet in the kitchen. He could push his way out the back door, knocking her over if he had to, and go get Kate, and they could get on a bus somewhere right then. People did things like that all the time. Peter was sure of it. He was 14 already, and by the summer Kate would be, too.
You're not going back there, his mother said, cutting across his thoughts.
Back where?
To that school. For trash girls like Kate Gleason to try to pin you down.
Fine. Done. Kate won't be going back either, you know. Graduation is in 3 weeks.
No, I mean you won't be going back, ever. Not tomorrow, not for graduation, not for anything.
He stared at her.
What are you talking about?
Now you're listening.
I'm calling Dad.
No, you're not. She rushed across the kitchen and tore the handset from the phone. The late afternoon sun fell as a square across the table. Peter felt its heat on his leg, on his fingertips.
Okay, Mom. Peter held up his hands. Let's say I don't go back.
Does it bother you that everyone hates you? Go to your room.
Nope.
She threw the phone across the room, but Peter dodged it. He felt wound up enough to sprout wings and fly away. Go to your room!
No.
She opened the drawer where she kept serving spoons, wooden spoons, a whisk, a few spatulas, a heavy cast iron mallet she used to tenderize meat. She lifted the mallet over her head and rushed at him. He caught her by the wrist and held it.
Stop it, Peter said.
Stop. His mother released the mallet and it clattered to the floor. She looked around as if she'd mislaid something, as if something important had gone undelivered. Peter pushed the chairs neatly up to the lip of the table, one by one.
You are not going to see that girl again, she said.
I will, said Peter, and then left her. His father always seemed to want to diffuse things by agreeing with her.
Okay, Anne, he'd say,
and his face would go blank as he stared straight ahead and pushed through to whatever task would bring him out of the scene, away from her. He'd turn on the television, or disappear into the garage, or head over to the Grasshopper pub for a few hours.
You're right, he'd say.
And then he'd move around as if in a fugue state, as if nothing had happened. If he spoke at all, he'd talk about the price of gas, about whether the deer population had exploded in recent years or whether it just seemed that way. One exception was the previous Thanksgiving, when Peter's uncle, his father's brother George, made a rare trip to Gillam from Sunnyside with his new wife, Brenda. George Stanhope was 10 years younger than Brian, and the brothers didn't even look like relatives. Where Brian was blonde and lean, George had a barrel chest and thick arms from lifting iron beams into place all day long. He was short and dark and had a belly that hung a little over his belt. His wife seemed not that much older than Peter. She worked in the union office, handled the insurance claims and workman's comp. Peter had only met George a handful of times, once at a diner in the Bronx, another time at a funeral his father had dragged him along to because it was a Thursday in the summer and his mother was at work. At the diner, George had pretended he just found a brand new package of baseball cards and casually asked Peter if he had any interest. At the funeral, while all the adults were standing together in the parking lot of the cemetery, George folded up a $20 bill and tucked it into the pocket of Peter's shirt. Peter was only about 6 or 7 at the time and had no idea what to do with a $20 bill.
Bet you'd like to be somewhere else, George had whispered.
Another time, Peter came home from school to find George helping his dad take a tree stump out of the ground, and it was like coming home to find a celebrity waiting for him. The three of them ate pizza on the back steps, and though Peter hoped and hoped George would stay longer, that he would stay all night and wake up to have breakfast with them the next morning, he somehow understood that George would leave before Peter's mother came home. When his father told him that George and Brenda were coming for Thanksgiving, Peter cautiously checked his excitement in case the plan would change. For years, Peter had looked over at the cars pulling up at the Gleasons and the Maldonados on Thanksgiving and Christmas, but not once had a car ever pulled up to his house on those days. Peter imagined George walking through their front door carrying a tower of bakery boxes like the Gleasons' guests all seemed to do. When George arrived, even before he introduced his wife, he put his hand on Peter's shoulder, and Peter felt as if he knew his uncle much better than just those few times they'd actually spent together.
You doing good? George asked him. Pretty tall now, huh? Your dad, he puts fertilizer in your shoes?
All went well for a while. The adults discussed the election, poor Michael Dukakis, whether Kitty had really burned a flag in college or if Bush's people had made that up. Peter went out to the driveway for a while to check out the pogo stick George had brought for him. Kate shouted hello from her bedroom window, and Peter waved. But when he went back inside, the mood had changed. In just 15 minutes, Peter's mother seemed to have taken a strong dislike to George's wife, Brenda. She made a twist of her mouth whenever the younger woman spoke,
and Peter saw George noticing. There hadn't been a wedding, Peter had gathered, but he didn't see why that would bother anyone. George was the first to raise his voice.
"Cool it,"
he said to Anne, raising a hand to indicate he'd had enough. Anne raised her voice back at him, and after a few minutes of shouting, Anne went to the closet and got the vacuum cleaner. She lifted it over her head, and George's wife shrieked as Anne swung it at all of them. They all dodged it, but three water glasses went flying, along with some cutlery, a dish of mashed potatoes. All of it skidded across the wood floor, onto the carpet. His father yelled at his mother like Peter had never heard before, and his mother, still holding the vacuum, squeezed her eyes shut. Peter took a step back, took another step back until he felt the wall behind him, and watched. When his mother finally went upstairs, slamming the door to her bedroom so hard that the whole house shook, the four people remaining in the dining room looked around at the mess and at each other.
"What the fuck, Brian?" George said. "What was she so mad about? Did I miss something?"
"You can't reason with a person who won't be reasoned with," Brian said quietly, a plea that his brother not push, an acknowledgement that there was something going on that he'd lost control of, that he didn't understand, that he'd have to do something about, and soon.
"Didn't I tell you?" George asked. "Didn't I tell you what, 15 years ago?
"George," Brian said, and glanced quickly at Peter. But instead of letting it go, of feigning harmony as all adults did, George turned and studied Peter.
"You're a cool customer, aren't you?"
Who was the first to start laughing? George, probably. His father got a bottle of something from a cabinet, and when George poured a little quarter-inch measure in the bottom of a water glass and handed it to Peter, his father didn't object. His mother showed no signs of coming back downstairs.
"You okay, sweetie?" Brenda asked Peter after a while.
The brothers were getting louder. Brian pounded his fist on the table as he told some story from growing up, and Peter felt as if he were listening to a stranger.
"Yeah, I'm fine. Why?"
Peter said breezily, as if he wasn't sure why she was asking. The first sip of alcohol had burned a path down his throat to his belly. His breath felt hotter when he exhaled. He took the rest in one gulp, as he'd seen George and his father do.
"Okay, tough guy, okay."
The potatoes were still on the floor, the glasses topsy-turvy on the carpet. He could just push the potatoes back into the bowl and dump them in the kitchen garbage can. The glasses he could collect in one pass and stand them up in the sink so that no one would step on them and maybe get a cut on their feet. He looked around to check if everyone was wearing shoes. But cleaning up felt like it might ruin something. So instead he just turned his back to the mess and let it be. He'd never heard his father be loud. He'd never seen him pound a table. He didn't know whether witnessing his father like that made him happy or afraid. George tilted the flimsy chair back on two legs. They'd moved from the dining room to the kitchen, and still, the mess stayed exactly where it had landed. George poured another quarter inch into Peter's glass. Brian Stanhope looked, but didn't object.
"I'm just gonna," Peter said as he grabbed a wad of paper towels and turned back to the spilled food.
Brenda followed with a damp sponge.
Inside the Gleason's house, Kate tried to make sense of what had happened while her mother wrapped an ice cube in a gauze-thin kitchen cloth and made Kate suck. Her teeth were fine, but she'd bitten her tongue so hard that there were two swollen purple dashes there, and every time she moved her head, they let loose a little more blood. It didn't seem like much when Kate went over it, but the sum added up to more than the parts.
"You think you're so smart," Mrs. Stanhope had said. Kate wondered if it bothered her so much because it was true. She did think she was smart. It was as if she'd pried open Kate's secret and stuck her finger in it, stirring it around until the most shameful part emerged. The whole exchange, only a minute long, already had the quality of a dream. Maybe, Kate thought, being an adult, Mrs. Stanhope saw something in her that Kate, having no perspective, couldn't see, and that her own mother couldn't see because she loved her so much.
Kate recalled a morning a few weeks before, dress down day at school. For a dollar, every kid could show up in jeans and sneakers, just like the public school kids got to do every day, and the money would go toward new basketball uniforms for the boys. Kate brushed pink powder along her cheekbones that morning and imagined some of the boys might notice. That was the day that Deacon and Mrs. Gallagher came to teach the monthly sex ed class. They had 9 children. Their youngest had been in Sarah's class. And seeing them together, arranging the dittos at the front of the classroom before the deacon led the boys across the hall, she couldn't stop thinking that these two, she short and husky, like a fire hydrant on legs, he tall and angular and not a single hair on the top of his head, had done what Kate knew people had to do to get 9 children. That night, late, long after her sisters and parents were asleep, long after the throbbing in her tongue had finally dulled, Kate noticed a light shining on her bedroom wall. As soon as she noticed it, a circle in the dead center of the wall opposite the window, it blinked out. Then it returned. Then it blinked out again. When it returned, she went to the window. There, across the immense night, was Peter, standing at his bedroom window. He turned the flashlight to himself, and then to something he was holding in his hand. He raised the window screen and launched what looked to be a paper airplane into the darkness. He tried to follow it with the light, but the bright white of the paper and the circle of light kept chasing and passing each other, making something spectacular and frantic against the perfect stillness of the night. The plane landed on the grass, on Kate's side of the lawn. Peter found it and held the light steady for a second, then back up at Kate, who nodded and waved so he'd know she'd seen it, that she knew it was meant for her. 5. As the bus lumbered around the streets of Gillam and all day at school that Thursday, Kate's plan to meet Peter was like a warm stone she cupped in her hands. The paper airplane had been saturated with dew, but he'd anticipated that, writing the message in pencil so the words wouldn't run. She'd raced out the back door to get it before breakfast, before the rest of them had a chance to glance out the window and spot it there beside the holly bush. "Were you outside already?" her mother asked when Kate came back in, blades of wet grass stuck to her bare feet. "I thought I left a book out there," Kate said, and her mother shuffled on, bleary-eyed, without her first cup of coffee. Midnight, the note said. He had to talk to her. He probably wouldn't be at school. He hoped her mouth was okay. Meet him by the hedges. At breakfast, Natalie and Sarah wanted to know what had happened, exactly. They'd had a track meet the previous afternoon, came home late, and had to finish their homework. They only pieced together the clues that something was up when Kate refused to leave her room for dinner, and their mother banned them from the kitchen so she could talk to their father in private. "It was the craziest thing," Kate began, keeping her voice low. "Yeah?" Natalie said, grabbing an apple from the fruit bowl. "I fell off the rock and bit my tongue. Blood everywhere. Mrs. Stanhope came out and she was so mad. She asked me if I thought I was smart. Then Mom came out and smacked me so hard." But Kate felt their blank stares. She couldn't explain it. She couldn't boil the whole encounter down to one riveting sentence. "What's with you and Peter?" Natalie asked. "Are you two fooling around?"
"No!"
Kate cried as she felt a ball of light gather under her breastbone. The simple fact that Kate was still at St. Bart's, and Nat and Sarah were a senior and a sophomore at Gillam High, meant that her stories could never be as interesting as theirs. Nothing rated until high school. Sarah leaned over her bowl to get closer to Kate. "Nat's going out with Damien Reed."
"Sarah!"
Natalie said.
"She won't tell,"
Sarah said. "Oh," Kate said, as she felt her own story get shouldered aside. She didn't know who Damien Reed was. Sarah continued. "She said that if she ever gets pregnant, she'll rent a car, drive to Texas, get an abortion, and tell Mom and Dad she's at a track meet."
"Sarah!"
Natalie said again, this time with more feeling.
"I'll kill you!"
"Why Texas?" Kate asked. Nat sighed. It doesn't have to be Texas. Somewhere far.
Wouldn't you want someone to go with you?
If they'd expected her to be prudish about it, she hadn't given them the satisfaction. Sarah would come, Natalie said, looking at Sarah to confirm this was true. She turned to Kate. You could come if you wanted to. Not now, but in a couple of years. Not that I expect it to ever happen. Kate considered this. And if you guys ever need one, you can say you're visiting me at school, Nat said, closing the subject. She was heading to Syracuse in the fall. Their mother came in and began taking everything she'd need out of the fridge and the bread box to make their lunches. Whisper, 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 she said as she counted out 6 slices of bread, 3 black plums, 3 bottles of Snapple. She opened a tub of tuna salad.
You'd all better be ready for the bus. I don't feel like driving anyone this morning.
Mrs. O'Connor looked up from her attendance sheet and said his name twice, before moving on. At gym, Mr. Chavone announced that it was Peter Stanhope's turn to be captain, and then looked around at everyone before naming another boy instead. Kate felt a hum of fear and joy rush through her every time his absence was noted, as if the shape of him were there beside her. Idly, throughout the day,